Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, my darling true crime angels, to Trisha's True Crime Radio Show, the only show that can mix oil and water and mix it wonderfully well. Hey, tonight we have an incredible show for you. We're going to be talking to a PI who has been down in the trenches and up in the skies and has been all over the world doing all kinds of work. We're going to find out everything we want to know about a private investigator. Also, an incredible lawyer from Texas will join us to kind of add a little bit of color and legal thoughts to our whole conversation tonight. But first, today's show is sponsored by Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. Just go to www.pauseforpurplehearts.org. Okay, it's the goo thing. We're going to goo ourselves with legal stuff. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. Now, I do have an update for you. A lot of people have been asking about Michael in Minnesota, and I don't know, some of you may not know this, but he had a terrible tragedy. Michael's whole house burnt down, and when I say burnt down, I mean it was burnt down. They think a fire started in the garage with an old electrical outlet. He was lucky to get out with his life. He barely got out with his life. But tragically, three of his four animals did not. And you know Michael. Michael treats his animals like most of us do, and that's like part of his family. So to say he's devastated, it doesn't really describe it. But he is doing okay. He appreciates all the wonderful emails and thoughts and prayers. And on behalf of Michael, I want to tell you, keep him coming, because he can really, really use it. My heart just breaks for that man. It is a tragedy, but I guarantee you, he will overcome, even though I'm sure at times he must feel like he can't take any more. It's an awful lot for a person to handle. So, Michael, we love you, and we're here for you, my dear, anytime. Okay, let's talk about this. We have with us tonight a seasoned private eye. That sounds like a sort of a, like a, you know, he's a piece of steak or something. His name is Kelly Townsend. And Kelly is the chief investigator for Lien and Bond Investigations in Arizona. And Kelly has really pretty much, I think, seen it all is a great way we can describe it. So let's go to Kelly. Kelly, how are you, my dear?
I'm doing fine, Trish. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Hang tight, because also joining us tonight is another seasoned, he's like a well-seasoned Texas T-bone. I am talking about Drew Siegel, attorney at law. And Drew, welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. How are you?
Thank you. I am terrific. How are you tonight?
I'm great. Okay, I have these two gentlemen on. We're going to have a very, very interesting show. First, we're going to talk to Kelly about what it's like to be a private investigator. Now, a lot of the people on Web Sleuths and Forums for Justice, we rely on private investigators to give us a lot of information that we need when it comes to true crime. But I was talking to my son tonight, and I was trying to tell him why a private investigator is such a good thing for a family of a missing person to have, because basically, they can do a lot of things that law enforcement can't, as we will find out tonight. But let's go to Kelly Townsend first. Kelly, how long have you been a PI?
A little over 20 years.
Okay. And so how did you get started? So you just didn't wake up one day and said, hey, I want to be a private investigator.
No, actually, a gentleman by the name of Logan Clark was a friend of mine, and he hunted missing persons, and he asked me if I wanted to go along. So we went along, and I went with him, and we found the missing girl due to something that I thought up, an angle to get her, basically to shake her out of the trees, I guess is the best way to put it. So he asked me to come work for him, so I've been doing it ever since then. You know, missing persons is kind of a calling. You don't get rich doing missing person cases, believe me.
Yes. I know. I can understand that. I'm sure you do a lot of pro bono work. Is that mostly what you do, is missing persons?
No. I do criminal defense investigations, missing persons, human trafficking investigations, background checks, asset checks, surveillance. We've got a very good team of covert surveillance agents who, so far, I mean, you know, anybody says they never get burned is lying. but we do that. And those kind of things are what really pays the bills.
Kelly, back up. When you say nobody gets burned and you have a group of surveillance agents? What does that mean? What are you talking about there?
Getting burned means so the target spotted you and recognizes that maybe your vehicle or the individual. So then what you do is you either, if it's the vehicle, the agent just changes the vehicle out. If it's the person, then we change the person and then go back into the surveillance. But that's what burn means, is that you've been found out.
So what you're surveilling, what are you surveilling? Is this for insurance companies, or what is it for?
Sometimes, yeah. For workers' comp, insurance, fraud cases. Sometimes on criminal matters, we do some surveillance. In missing person cases and human trafficking, we do surveillance. I mean, surveillance can fall into play in many, many different forums. Most PIs, they do worker comp surveillance because you've got these big brokerage firm agencies that subcontract out to detectives all over the country, nationwide. And we're on a few of those lists as well, where we'll get a call and they'll say, I've got a couple of surveillances. Like, we just finished one yesterday where the gentleman was claiming that he was depressed, too depressed to drive his car, and he had such anxiety he couldn't get out of bed. And we were on a three-day gig. Well, the guy who's driving a Carrera Porsche owns a Shelby Cobra Mustang. He goes to the gym 2 hours a day and flies all over town in his Porsche. So if that's depression, I want some of it. And he lives in a million-dollar home. he's soon going to be. So then we pop on covert cameras and basically went in. My wife is my partner, has been for 20 years, and because the husband and wife team can get through a lot more doors than just me by myself, because I'm 6'4" and pretty ugly. So, so what we did was we went in there and just did your basic, show me the facility. And so all of a sudden I look over to the right and I said, man, it looks like the guy. And so then started doing some repetitions and just got the photographs and videos that we needed. So I have a feeling that there'll be a case that it's not in Texas, so this gentleman won't be able to represent him, but I have a feeling there'll be some criminal charges filed against him.
I was going to bring my Texas lawyer in, Drew Siegel. Drew Siegel, what comment on that? What if this was your client?
Well, I was going to tell Kelly I was looking for a 6'4 guy in Arizona who's really ugly, so I'm going to get his number.
Sweet. All right.
Most of the things that I have been involved in, it's infidelity in marriages where the wife or the husband suspects the other, and so they send a private investigator after them. And
yeah, we
Kelly
do that
said,
as well.
There's a lot of workers' comp where I haven't heard stories as great as his, but they say they can't walk, they can't do whatever, and then they catch them riding a bicycle to the grocery store and carrying everything home. And
funny
you just
that.
Catch them right-handed. Oh, you know one of those?
Oh, there's a guy that we posted up where his medical appointment was going to be. He gets out of his car, he's walking bad, he gets the walker out of the back seat, and he does his walker into the doctor's appointment, comes back out, and we're just sitting outside, and goes back out, puts the walker in, gets in his car, drives to the park, and starts to jog. I was just dying on that. Another guy went into a dog park, was running. I mean, it's just, there's so many stories that you find out. And the point for this, some people get a little mad at it, but the thing is there's so much rampant fraud out there that insurance companies do have to, they have certain red flags. And they'll send PIs out there to prove whether these people are telling the truth or not. And I've had several cases that, but I say the ones that deserve the money, by God, get it to them. And I've only had a handful where they actually, to me, while I'm watching them over a period of 3 or 4 days, I'm saying, man, this guy really does need the medical assistance. Now, I can't make I can't purport any medical expertise, so we have to put it in a generic fashion. The person was mobile or he had failure use of his left hand and things like that. And there was a case out of Yuma that I'm thinking about where the gentleman truly did deserve to get the disability pay. but I would say probably 85% of the cases that we work are complete, they're just frauds. You know, just a week before this case that I did there, a young kid, 23 years old, gets in a car accident. A month later, he says he's got injuries to his back and that he can't lift anything over 25 pounds. Mm-hmm. We catch him at the Infiniti dealership working in the service area, running around washing cars all over the place, you know. And so there's another one, you know. I mean, I can go on for a long time on that, but the one thing I think the insurance company should do to start putting a bit of a stop on it is they need to start prosecuting more. They'll cut off their pay and they just won't prosecute because, you know, the legal expenses.
Let me reintroduce everybody because there are people just joining us now. We're talking with Kelly Townsend. Kelly is a private investigator and has been for over 20 years. And Kelly has his he's the chief investigator for Lien and Bond Investigations in Arizona. And out of Texas, we have Texas lawyer Drew Siegel. We're talking about what a private investigator does because on Web Sleuths and Forums for Justice, and I see it on Facebook all the time, people are hiring PIs to do things that a cop can't do. And Kelly, let's go to you here for a moment. Why would somebody come to you if they're missing a loved one? The police have already got a case opened about it. What can you offer with a missing loved one that the police can't?
Well, if it's a runaway, the police virtually do nothing. We have cases, and the first thing I tell the family is, have you got her listed on NCIC? Because NCIC is a data bank that goes all around the country to all the cops that are in cruisers. And that's a database that, you know, terrorists are in there, runaways are in there, missing persons, fugitives, you name it, they're in that database. But when NCIC lists them as an endangered missing person, then we can actually, if they're listed as endangered, if there's a cell phone involved, we can ping the cell phone or law enforcement can ping the cell phone. We had a case here in Mesa, which shocks me, was the department has one person in Mesa, Arizona, that works missing persons. And number one, I guess to answer your question, is we probably have more personnel and we can actually spend time sitting on a house or doing surveillance. Or in this one case, Tanya, is the Mesa police worked with us, which is great because sometimes law enforcement doesn't want to cooperate and help us. But she actually was pinging the phone and then calling me with the longitude and latitudes. So then I input them into a GPS finder and then out we'd go. And with their help, doing that stuff, we found the girl within 48 hours, and she had been missing for 2 weeks. And so, because the biggest fears that I have when I work missing person cases, I had daughters, and I know it would just freak me out if they were gone at any period of time, is what's out there. You have trafficking recruiters that are out there. They know where the runaways hide. For example, in Tucson, Arizona, we did a case up there. Two cases that I think I told you about, the Discovery ID channel. They were there filming these cases, and it'll be on TV in June. But there's an underground world there. These kids live in the water pipes, the sewers underground. And when we were looking for crawling in these pipes, I mean, you could see where there's fires, where the manholes would be. You could see where they have fires, so it goes up through there. You would see stashes of food. And it was like a code in there. People wouldn't take another person's food or candy or junk like that because during the day they're up there doing what they do, which a lot of times is panhandling. And so then at night they come down. Of course, when it rains, they get a remodeling.
Oh, that's so tragic. So they have an actual community set up there of these runaway kids, and that's just in one area. I'm sure it's in every state in the union, which is so tragic.
In every state and every city, these guys know, and recruiters are the individuals who they're very, very astute at how to manipulate somebody. And every runaway or missing person, I mean, they have a reason why they ran away. And what the recruiter does is they try and fulfill that need. So if it's love, a hug, do you need food? Do you need clothing? they will fulfill that need to bring that child in. And the thing is the profile of a recruiter is very similar to the profile of a domestic violence abuser, because mm-hmm. the domestic violence abuser, what they do, they alienate, they segregate, they take away transportation, they take away access to money, so now you're technically their prisoner. And the only difference is in human trafficking is once they take you, they're going to beat you, they're going to get you addicted to drugs, and then they're mm-hmm. going, once they feel that they can take the leash off, then they will put you out on the street and prostitute you. And the thing is, in human trafficking, it's becoming a larger industry for one purpose. You can take one girl and or boy. Boys are starting to become more prevalent now, too, I've noticed. But they can turn that person 6 to 8 times a day and relatively bring in $2,500 to $3,000, depending on what they do, a day.
And they've got how many? You know, a whole bunch. Yeah,
there's thousands. Literally, 20. This is FBI statistics, and I always question how they get some of these. But 2,100 people go missing a day. If you just divide that in 24 hours, look at how many people disappear an hour in this mm-hmm. country. Now, probably 60 to 65% of them are parental abductions. Then you've got runaways, and then you have genuine missing persons. And the missing persons, the ones, like here, there's a case that you may be familiar with. Her name, the little girl's name is Isabel Celis.
We've been working that case
for 2 years now. And we have, and this is, again, where I have problems sometimes with law enforcement. I mean, the job's tough enough, but we have evidence of who did it. But that person's in Florida, and TPD, which is the Tucson Police, refused to do anything about it. And so we can't fly out there because if they slam the door in our face, he's already got a criminal. I mean, put it this way, who leaves 3 days after a child disappears because she was taken out of her bedroom window? 3 days after she would disappear, he goes has his Jeep flown to Florida or driven. I don't know how he transported it, but it wasn't by him. And then he went to live in a KOA in Seattle, Washington. Florida, but
how is he connected to her?
He lived in the home.
And
they called him an uncle, but he wasn't. He was like a second cousin, but he lived in the home. And the thing is no dogs barked. And every time I was in the Celis' house, those little dogs would bark up a storm. So mm-hmm. I find that suspicious. There were several things. And not only that, but the police had said that they vetted this individual that he was in a strip club. Well, the guy that was with him all night says, no, we were at a rave. So we found streetlight photos at 1:30 in the morning, one block away from the Isabel Celis' home. Nobody brought that up. Nobody talks about that stuff. I work with,
and here you are. You've got it all, and they're not doing anything. Please continue.
Yeah, well, I work with a group called Find Me, and it's find like the word and me, and on the website it's findme2.com, run by a gentleman, good friend of mine. He's a 30-year retired DEA, and we actually have the resources. It's strictly a volunteer group. But we have airplanes that we can fly over and do satellites. We have a complete search and rescue dog team, cadaver dogs, scent dogs. We found Jack Koulios' body in Tempe Town Lakes when nobody else could find him. Our search team, dog team, actually found him. I get frustrated when we know something and we can't even get a sit-down with Tucson Police Department.
Do you think that the police department resent you and are like kind of jealous of you and they just don't want to give you the credit? And that sounds so petty, and maybe you don't want to admit that, but that just really bothers.
I think maybe it's more it's a little bit that they look down like we're not real cops, and also the fact that they don't want somebody else to do the job and prove that they didn't do it accurately. Because when we have worked, for example, the Koulios matter, law enforcement had dive teams. Everybody, there was 6 or 7 volunteer groups, all searched this area. But what Kelly Schneider and myself did was we sat down and figured about what the temperature of the water was, how long until the gases come up, what about rain, and Kelly says, man, I think he's going to pop up out of the water here at this day. We went on a Saturday. I searched all day. The dogs had somewhat of a hit. Went on Sunday, and in an hour and a half, we found the body. And so, you know, it's sometimes I think that in that case, the police, they kind of resented us because we found them where they were looking.
And they should be patting you on the back and saying, thank you. You were able to do something we weren't able to, and now we've got this resolved. Who cares? As long as it gets done.
For the family. I mean, you know, this kid disappeared from Cadillac Ranch. That was a place where he's drinking, and he was underage. So they kicked him out, and he took off. I mean, the tragedy was it wasn't foul play. He was running on the side of there's a big drop-off. He was running on the side. He was drunk, and he literally just fell over and then rolled down, smacked his head, and probably stumbled into the water and drowned.
Oh, that is so tragic. There are some people in chat room that have a couple of questions for you. And, Drew, hang tight. We're going to get to you in just a second here. But we're talking with Kelly Townsend, Chief Investigator of Lien and Bond Investigations. We're going to find out everything we can about the life of a PI because we all want to be detectives. And I think the closest we'd ever get to it is listening to you talk, Kelly. But two questions. First of all, do you have assistance? Like, can somebody, is that usually the case with a private investigator? Can somebody go in and say, hey, you know, I can follow people, I can do this, I can do that? And do you hire people off the street? How does that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on the state, what their licensing requirements are. In the state of Arizona, you have to work for an investigation agency for 3 years before you can actually get your own PI license. Other states like California, if you pass the test and have 2,100 hours, Nevada is pretty much the same thing. But in Arizona, what I like about Arizona is you actually have to have evidence that you did the job for 3 years. And you can't be jumping around and stuff like that because it's called an employee tag. So, yes, you can get hired. Just find out in what state you're in. Call a local private detective's office and ask them what are their requirements to have them come work for them, you know. And most of the time when you start out, you'll start off with surveillance. And surveillance is a lot of boredom and, you know, seconds of adrenaline because you're just sitting there. You know, and that's where I love. That's one of the reasons I came up with the business that I own on the side, which is called StealthFind, which is a GPS tracking device business. And because in many states, because as you were saying, we don't have the restrictions. There's really only one state in the union right now that flat out made a statute, and that was California, that says in the statutes that if a private investigator is caught utilizing a tracking device, then they lose their license. So many people argue that, well, you can't do that legally. No, law enforcement has to get a warrant. We don't have to get a warrant.
Right. That's the beauty of being a private investigator is you don't have to follow those rules.
Have less red tape to go through.
There you go, red tape, that's the word. So, Kelly, let's say a family comes to you and says, I have a missing son, he's a runaway, the police don't want to have anything to do about it. And this is from the chat room, and I think it's an important question. Would you charge them? How much do you charge them? How does that work? What's a typical case like this cost?
Well, depending on how long the child's been gone, but how we charge is an hourly rate within a retainer that the hourly rate is worked against it. The first things that we do, and this is really important to anybody listening to the show, in case their child does run away, is you want to get their computer, laptop, hard drive, get that and wait. Now, if the police just say, hey, we're not going to do anything but take a missing persons report, find a qualified private investigator, somebody who actually has found a missing person. Ask them, what cases have you solved? Have you ever, what cases have you worked? Because there's many cases, you know. I was asked, you know, how many have you saved? I said, the number that I think of is how many I didn't find. But, you know, so we go through the computer. I actually have a product that's a recovery stick where I put it in the phone of a cell phone or into the hard drive. And it will extract all deleted information. That's emails, pictures, social media, anything that's deleted. Because the juice of what I want to find is in there. Because especially in a runaway situation, they're doing something, and before they ran away, they don't want to. They think by deleting it, it won't be found. Well, that's not true. You delete something, it's always going to be on your computer. The next step is, who are their friends? And we go interview their friends. And then if their friends, because the friends will say, well, yeah, I saw them last night. Then they went over to Frank's or over to Ethel's or whatever. And you basically try and develop as many leads as you can. And just like any investigator, you start knocking those leads off one at a time. Mm-hmm. Where does it take you? Because it can branch out like a tree. All of a sudden you get no, nothing, and then all of a sudden, bingo. Well, yeah, this happened. So then you head out to that, and eventually you narrow it down. Brianna Kramer is a prime example of, she was a missing teen, again, out of Tucson, and we hit the pavement for 8 days straight, just knocking the trees, but we actually had a blessing in that case where we had identified and found the vehicle of the woman that took her, and we stuck a tracking device on it. So then we started, we knew where she was going. I set up zones and stuff, but, you know, I knew she wasn't going to be hiding where that girl lived. So so you start breaking those leads down, and then flyers. Flyers, people don't have any idea of how important posting of flyers are, where they were last seen, where they go to school, at home, around their home, and things like that. Because you put the private investigator's phone number on there, or the parent's number, something like that. You know, put the police number down. But 9 out of 10 times, if somebody's going to give inside information, they're not going to want to give it to the cops. And I have actually found children based on these posters where I get a phone call saying, "I know where she's at. Here's the address. I want to be anonymous, leave me alone." And we honor that. We have to debrief the police once we find the missing child. And they say, "How did you do that?" I said, "I can't tell you. I can tell you I got an anonymous tip, but I'm not going to tell you who this person is."
And does that make them angry? Does that make the cops angry?
Sometimes. Yeah. I mean, most of the time I'd say no, you know, because most of the time at that point, you know, we've got the child back and everybody's a little relieved. Children's cases can be different, you know, because everybody's got a kid.
Yeah, and everybody wants to help. That's true. But let's say you're looking for an adult. Have you ever had this scenario, Kelly, where the family hires you, you find the adult, and the adult's like, "I don't want anything to do with them. I want them to leave me alone."
Yes, as a matter of fact.
And so let's talk about that dynamic. What happened in that particular case?
Basically, we had a gentleman who was an attorney out of New York, and he could not find, he said the last known location was, this gentleman was in Arizona. He's a recluse, and they needed us to find him because he actually, it was good news I was bringing somebody, and I was kind of pleased about that because he had inherited $100,000.
Wow.
And so we had to track the guy down. We found him in a little apartment in Phoenix, Arizona, off of 43rd Avenue. The guy would never come to the door. I mean, banging on the door, and I says, "Well, I'm going to leave a card. Come back the next day, bang on the door." He never answers it, leave another card. Finally, I get this call saying, "Why do you keep putting cards on my door?" I says, "Because I want to talk to you."
Yeah.
So, but now here's the crazy thing is, he didn't want the money. I said, "Take the money. Donate it to somebody. I've got all kinds of organizations." Well, his problem was, is that his sister manipulated something to do with the will and wasn't honoring the aunt's true wishes. So he says, "I don't want anything to do with that money." And I was like, "Man, you could do some good with it, because if not, the state's going to take it, your sisters are going to take it." And he basically kicked me out. He says, "I don't want anything to do with it. I never want to see you again." So,
oh, man, you know, that would never happen to me. I would never get a knock on the door like that.
Ugh. I tell you, I mean, I'm here to deliver good news, and he's telling me go away.
We're going to bring go ahead. What were we going to say, Kelly?
No, I can't see you. I could have found someplace to put that money.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're going to bring in.
There's tons of good organizations.
Oh, absolutely. Drew Siegel. Drew is an attorney in Texas, and he comes on every once in a while just to tell us what he thinks about what's going on, because his mind is as sharp as a tack, right, Drew?
Well, I'd like to think so. I don't know.
Drew, now, in your experience, have you ever – do you use private investigators in your law practice?
From time to time. It is usually – just to go out and get statements from witnesses. There's no real tracking kind of things like Kelly does. So the things I do are much more mundane. But I did want to ask Kelly, human trafficking, is there anything more to it than drugs and then prostitution? Is there anything else that is considered human trafficking?
Well, that's labor trafficking. No, the most popular is the sex trafficking because they make the most money at it. But there is what's called labor trafficking. We had a case with a gentleman that came out here from South Africa, and he was working in Florida on not a plantation, but let's just say for farm, for lack of better words in my mind. Mm-hmm. And so they purported to him and many other guys that came with him from South Africa, here's your living conditions, showing beautiful pictures, here's what's going to happen, yada, yada, yada. They get there, there's 10 of them bundled into a little apartment with cots on the floor. And they were not getting paid the money that they promised them, and they were not getting the food that they were deserved. And so this guy was referred to us by someone from a church and mm-hmm. that he went to. And so that's when we went down there and we got him out. And he's actually filing for asylum right now, because if you are a victim of trafficking in the United States, you mm-hmm. can get asylum.
Okay.
Interesting. Is there, you know, a lot of times when you hear about human trafficking, you think, well, they've been shipped overseas to Hong Kong. Does that ever really happen?
Yes, actually, yes. So many people draw a blind eye to it because it is a very horrendous situation. My wife and I were sitting and talking to a woman because we were at a charity function. We have a team that's called 12 Legions of Angels. We're 12legionsofangels.com, but the number 12. And what we do is it's a boots-on-the-ground rescue team mixed of military and retired law enforcement. And we literally will go and extract somebody, even if it's in Mexico. We've done that. We've gone to Thailand and different countries. But I forgot what the question was, to be honest with you.
Do the people really get taken, stolen, and sent overseas?
Well, one lady, yes, they do. And one lady that we were talking to, she had said, well, they're there voluntarily. And my wife had a bit of a heart attack. She says, that's like saying a child that's been taken asked to be molested.
Right.
These people are taken against their will. So, yeah, the problem is all over the world. One of the things that we've seen is someone will promote, I need a model or I need an actress.
Model, right.
And we're going to do a shoot in Europe. The woman then flies out there, all looks legit, they're giving them money, et cetera. Once they land, they take their passports. Or they've even gone other steps is, okay, now I'm sorry, you're just not right for the movie, but what do mm-hmm. I do? And then they ask them to leave and say, well, we can give you a job working at our club. And next thing you know, they now owe them money, and a lot of times what they'll do is they say, okay, but you know, you're going to have to pay me back for the trip because you didn't qualify. And they, mm-hmm. that's how it starts. And then next thing you know, they're getting into the life. They get on drugs. Drugs is a big thing. That's why these safe houses that we brought people to, one of the qualifications is, you know, do you have somebody who can get them off drugs first? Mm-hmm. Because if they don't get them off drugs, then they're going to run away again because they're going to get high. And they'll go straight back. I've seen it happen.
There's been people who, women, let's face it, it's mostly women, who go for a legitimate job, and they're taken mm-hmm. overseas, and their family doesn't see them again. Now, are these kids that take these jobs, or these young adults, are they mostly runaways? Are they troubled? What are we talking about?
No,
here?
No,
a little
no,
bit of everybody.
No. You have that, but there's people that legitimately, I mean, they thought they were getting hired, and they're very beautiful girls. Blonde hair, blue-eyed girl overseas fetches tons of money. I wish mm-hmm. I had that sheet in front of me that talks about, well, the price of what a child goes for and a girl goes for in each country. But they'll go up there for a legitimate job. At least they think mm-hmm. it's legitimate. And then they're taken. Well, I'm not even sometimes taken. They're just manipulated into business. You know, in the United States. Yeah, in the United States, I mean, it's not big groups. I mean, don't get me wrong. Organized crime has mm-hmm. huge groups out there. that traffic people, but you get these guys that'll, there'll be one person that has three girls. Look at the guy that was in Cleveland, Ohio, who had those girls for 10 years. You know, that's trafficking, and a lot more charges too. Kidnapping, false imprisonment, rape, you name it. But so, neighborhoods, there was a case the other day where somebody found that they had brought this woman. She was not only did labor slave work, but she was forced to have sex.
That's right. So, in other words, a lot of missing persons' families, and I don't blame them, hold on to the hope that their child may be overseas. And that is not an unrealistic, if I'm hearing you right, that's not an unrealistic thing to hold out for, is it? I mean, it may not be likely,
not
but
at all.
It can be. It really can be.
Oh, no. And the thing is that these guys are very good. I mean, they do professional passports. They're fake, but they look very professional because traffickers actually fly these girls to certain places. Like, you hear about Super Bowls and big events, all of a sudden trafficking goes up. Well, it's true because that's where the money is. So they'll actually fly these girls who are taken, they're being held against their will, on public airlines.
Oh, my gosh. That's just awful. We have a question from the – oh, go ahead, Kelly.
No, they are training airlines more now on how to spot traffickers.
Good, because I'm sure there are some really big red flags that if you know what they are, they'll be easy to spot. Let's hope, anyway. We have a question from the chat room, and that is, do you ever investigate any animal cruelty cases?
No.
Okay.
I'm not.
And so let's talk a little bit about some of the more bizarre things that you have seen in your life, because I'm all into the bizarre. And I think as a PI... And that's another reason why we have Drew Siegel on. I love the bizarre, Drew. I just do.
Oh, come
Drew,
on.
Are you there?
Just give me a minute. I'm here.
Okay.
If you're doing
no,
horses,
no.
I'm sure you've got some drama.
Oh, he's got all kinds of drama. So, Kelly, if you had to pick a story, let's say you're writing a book, and you had to pick a couple of stories that would start out the book, what would that be? What would those stories be?
We were working a missing person case. A child was a runaway here in Arizona, and we actually had tracked her all the way to Nogales, Arizona. We found the house that she was allegedly staying in, so we staked out in surveillance points, choke points and things like that. And we spotted the girl in a backyard. But what we also found was, through our surveillance, was that there's a whole lot more of these girls. And I'm talking, you know, there was probably 30 or 40 people that were being held captive in this house. And we started seeing U-Haul trucks and different types of trucks showing up. And so our fear was that, well, not my fear, but my take on it was that this is possibly a drop spot for trafficking victims. So we went to local law enforcement and went to customs, border patrol, and we showed them our surveillance video. We also showed them that we had a contract with the family to bring this girl home. And so we showed them the video. They looked at it, and they said, okay, let's go. I said, wait, on one ground, one condition, I get the girl. So once you guys go in, you clear the place, you got to give me that specific girl, because my job is to take her, because we could have done it differently. And taking the house ourselves, I would have had to get a lot more people, and the parents would have paid a hell of a lot more money. But we would have done that. But law enforcement cooperated in this situation. They took the house down, and they gave us the girl. What they had found inside was people that had been living there, like I said, 30 to 40 people, in horrendous conditions. I mean, just horrendous conditions. But that case right there was one that I would talk about. And then another one would be the Dakota Kilpatrick case. This is where, again, social media, I like the stuff the Internet provides and things, but parents, they need to start being nosy more. You can buy a clone program to see what your kid's doing on his computer every day. Because if you don't, they can get into social media sites. And in this situation, Dakota disappeared from her family because she went to meet this boy that's alleged he was 16 years old. She was 15 years old. And so we then, when the child went missing, we got hired by the parents, and when we finally found her, which took us probably about a week and a half, she was being held captive by a 30-year-old Hispanic male in his bedroom. and being obviously sexually assaulted. So I would probably say those two cases, return a child home to a safe family, I have to say a safe family, ones where they're not being molested and things like that, and we always do a debriefing and find out. Because if we do find out that somehow there's abuse going on, not where the kid's just making it up, then we won't take them. We won't take them there. We take them to the police, and then they debrief the child and then take them into CPS custody. But I would probably say that those two cases are ones that just come to my head that I love the feeling of what returning a child to a loving family. There's no amount of money in the world that can give you that gratification.
Absolutely. And explain what debriefing means. What does that mean when you say you debrief a child?
Asking the child, basically interviewing them, asking, finding out what's happened to them while they were gone, what caused them to leave the home, is there anything, and again, this is where my wife comes in handy, because anytime when we go on these girls, she's in the back seat, I'm driving, and I can tell anybody who's listening, you know, that's an investigator, never ride alone in a car with a young girl, because they can say something and it's done. You know,
you're done, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. So, so I would say those two cases are probably the best. But is the sex trade alive? Yes. Arizona, it's growing because we are a border town.
That is just so scary, because I used to hear people say, you know, oh, they've been stolen and they're in Taiwan. And, you know, I think, oh, come on, that doesn't really happen. And that was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, but it really does. And that's appalling.
Here's a case everybody over, Natalie Holloway.
Right. There you go. Who would have thought?
Yeah. I mean, especially there, you know, just back up a boat and away she goes.
Yep, there it goes. Awful. Well,
it really is, especially when it's one of your loved ones.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. We say this all the time on WebSource. We just can't imagine what these victims go through. You know, all we can do is offer a shoulder and whatever help we can. But, damn, to go through something like that, it is just an unbelievable hell that nobody, I'm sure, wants to experience. I want to ask you something. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
There's things that parents and family members can do. We just did a trade show at the Prepper Fest here in Arizona, at the Arizona Fairgrounds. Teen drivers, children, 5, 7, 8, 10, up. Every kid has a backpack from elementary school to college. This tracking device, they just pop down, and people are doing it, which I think is a great idea. I have some parents saying, I just wish I could put a chip in them. But you down where the flap is of the backpack, you put the tracking device down there, and you set up zones. At the school bus stop, at the school, over anywhere that they're going to go, around your home, because what happens is when they go across that zone, you can alert your cell phone within 5 seconds. That'll say, Johnny just went into school, or Johnny leaving school. Well, now the parent can look at the clock and say, wait a minute, he's leaving school early. Let's say it's a teen driver. I know my daughters, they beat the truancy phone call that you're supposed to get. If I had these back when those kids were growing up, I guarantee you I would have used them. Because what it does is it notifies the parent that the kid's okay. I had a mother call me saying, I've got one of your devices, and my daughter's no longer allowed to date this boy. How do I set up a zone around there? So I showed her how to do it, and she called me back and says, by God, if it didn't work, because I always say, don't give up your intelligence, you know, because then the kid will just go in a friend's car. So what she did was she called her up and said, hey, honey, you didn't finish your chore, and I don't think you finished your homework. She goes, Kelly, I literally watched her turn around on the monitoring panel and come home. And so, you know, there's always something the parent can say, but watch what's going on with the computer. There's clone programs. They're cheap nowadays. We've introduced the domestic violence package for people. I mean, domestic violence is something that it's really bad, because these people are being held captive. They have no money. They have no access. And the one thing that I'm trying to teach people in education comes to is if you haven't got the mustered up the courage to walk across that threshold, you're going to be abused. Why not gather evidence for it? And this gentleman who does family law, he probably can speak on this, because it's a he said, she said thing if no evidence is found. Father right groups are teaching guys how to get around certain things. But I look at it as think about being a cop before the dash cam. And it's just a simple DUI. And the guy says, I wasn't drunk. Well, now he's got had an arguable issue before the camera. But now you just play that camera in court, and the guy's dropping down, can't walk the line, slurring his words, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. The case is over. There is no more argument. So if you can get a recording of the abuse, I mean, you can go to electronic spy shops now and buy a plate that goes on your outlet, and it actually works. You know, it's like a cover plate. It looks just like a regular plug. It's got a camera and a microphone in it.
That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
My thing is get some evidence, because then there is no more argument. There's no more lies. In family court, sometimes I think it's he who lies the best and can't be proven a liar wins.
That, you know, you're right. Absolutely right. That's why everything you say, the more evidence you have, the more hard evidence you have, the easier it's going to be to prove that you're telling the truth. Absolutely.
Yes, ma'am. I'm totally
agreeing. We do have a question from the chat room. You touched on Natalie Holloway a bit there. And first, let me just tell you, we're talking to Kelly Townsend. Kelly is a wonderful private investigator from Arizona, and he is here. I said Arizona, right. He has his business is called Investigator Lien and Bond Investigations. Lien and Bond Investigations. So, Kelly, yes, there you go. You touched on Natalie Holloway, and Natalie Holloway is one of our big cases that we still, it still eats away at everybody. What do you think happened to Natalie Holloway?
Oh, this is all conjecture and speculation, but my initial take on it was because of nobody found a body anywhere, is that and I think someone had indicated that they had heard some boats, but out there that's probably not unusual. My take on it is, and I think the family actually hired some investigators who did go to a foreign country looking for traffickers, but they actually would walk in, and if you're going undercover, and that's the one thing with the human trafficking, is we have ministers that travel with us and EMTs in case something happens either spiritually or health-wise, because it is such a dark world. But they went in and said, I'd like to get a blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl. Well, you never just walk up and you come into from a foreign country and do that, and they got stabbed. But it's my contention that she was a boat taken. I think the gentleman Vandersloot probably inoculated her somehow to where she couldn't sleep, and a boat just backed up. They put her on the boat, and away they went. And that's
when you say away they went, do you think she's alive, or do you think she was dumped in the ocean?
It's been so long now, my guess would be that, no, she's probably not alive any longer.
Yeah, that's kind of...
It's been
that's,
too long. I mean, the life expectancy of somebody trafficked is 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think she was trafficked then? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I don't mean to...
I think she was sold into sexual slavery.
Okay,
she's
that's
a beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl. Mm-hmm. That's my contention, my beliefs.
And who's to say?
And they tore that
island
apart.
They did. They really did. Okay, we're going to change beats here just a little bit. We also have with us Drew Siegel, attorney at law in Texas. Drew, I'm going to get to you in just a moment, but I have one more area I want to get to with Kelly Townsend, private investigator from Arizona. Kelly, skip tracing. We hear that a lot. You know, somebody skips out. They owe you money. They owe you rent. Can people just do it now where years ago they couldn't? They'd have to hire you? Or is that software they provide... Does that really work? I mean, tell us about
that. Well, that's the thing. You've got things like Bin Verified and Telius and stuff. They are farmers of public information. That's free public information. Mm-hmm. We actually have data sources that we have to prove our licensing. We have to have people come into our offices, inspect the locks, see where we have locks and things like that. And then we get access to being able to get a full Social Security number. We have access to wants and warrants. In certain states, I can get motor vehicle information on my computer. Arizona, California, you have to physically go down there, and you have to be licensed to do so. But I tell most people that say, well, this is what I found on Bin Verified, you know, or InstaCheckmate. There's tons of them out there. It's all public information that you can find on the Internet yourself. Mm-hmm. So if they charge you a one-time fee and you don't want to go surfing around for $19.95, then click the button. I mean, we charge about $150, depending on what kind of skip it is. But I get calls for people that have been, where they're adopted, they were their parents, you know, they were adopted, and they want me to mm-hmm. find the biological parent. Now, depending on how generic the name is, if they say my father's name was Juan Garcia, and that's all I know, and I don't have a state, I'm going to have to tell them there's nothing I can do for them. Because it's just impossible. If they have a non-generic name, then it makes it a little easier, but you still need a state, location, approximate age. What I say is give me a last known address. I don't care if it's 20 years old, because our data sources will actually go back there and tell us who was living at that time in that home. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I see that there, or I find that there might be a relative. And, again, I talk about leads. And so then I'll do that, and then we'll do what's called a pretext call sometimes, and I'll be 1-800-FLOWERS or something like that, saying I've got a package for Kelly Townsend, and I need mm-hmm. to verify that when the person will be there, and they'll give up the information. I mean, there's many, many ways that you can do it. But, yes, I would say the advent of the Internet has helped a lot of people do their own skip tracing. Skip tracing used to be, and specifically for bounty hunters, fugitives. That's
right.
The old days, they were called skip tracers. Mm-hmm. Now they're called fugitive recovery agents.
That sounds so official and so much nicer than bounty
yeah.
hunter. You know,
that's when licensing
sounds like
came
it
in and
changed it all. Well,
yeah,
exactly. And I'm glad they have some licensing. Because, boy, they could get some yahoos there. Drew Siegel, attorney at law from Texas, my big friend in Texas. We're going to be wrapping it up here with Kelly Townsend. Do you have any questions for Kelly before we wrap things up?
No, he answered my question. I'm good.
He did. See, Kelly reads minds, too. A lot of people don't know that. He does.
Well,
Kelly,
Drew,
do me a favor.
If you ever need anything, I'd be love to help you.
I'll call you. Thanks man.
Kelly, do me a favor. Give me the websites that you would like us to look at. I know you have some websites of volunteers that help and go try and find runaways, and you have your business website. I want them all. I want them all.
Yeah. My business website is www.arizona, spelled out, and then P is in private, I is investigator, S is in service.com, PIS.com. Mm-hmm. Or PIS with one S, as my IT guy told me. That's my investigation website, which is going to be doing some construction on it. It's up and running, though. And then the tracking device business is www.stealthfind.com, stealth like the bomber, find like you're finding me.com. And we're going to be, our product page, we're going to be adding things like, because I've done some other shows and people are calling me wanting this stuff, so I'm going to start putting it in, like clone programs and things that you can get information, not just the GPS devices. Because I'm very big in wanting to help domestic violence victims. The problem is they don't have any money, and as my wife says, we've got to do two cases just to help one person out. And, you know, I had cancer in 2009, and I was diagnosed stage 4, and so we lost everything, but I'm still here, and my calling is to keep doing this, and I think that's why the Lord spared me.
Absolutely.
They gave me 6 months to live.
They
did? And that was with, that was with treatment. So, praise to God, I'm still here talking to you, young lady, so I'm one of the lucky ones.
Anything we can ever do to help, don't hesitate to ask. But I know you have more websites. You were talking about the Angel.
Oh,
and
yes.
I apologize,
12,
I didn't write it down.
It's the number 12, Legions, Legions, of angels.com.
Got it.
That's
sounds
picture,
like a great.
And there's some stuff that we've got on that website that talks about trafficking. And then the other one that I always promote is Find Me, and that's findme2.com. That's run by a gentleman named Kelly Schneider. Love the man. And we go, matter of fact, everybody's heading out to Colorado to do another search. We actually, the team found the carcass of a little boy, but I can't say anymore because that's still an open investigation. So those are the sites.
All right, Kelly. Well, we're going to have you on again whenever we have a PI question. You're our go-to guy. So thank you so much, Kelly. My best to your wife and to everybody who works with you, and tell them thank you from us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Drew, it was really nice talking to you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
He is a great guy, isn't he, Drew?
Yeah, I really like him.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Drew, you and I are going to talk about something that I was so stunned when I heard about it. I didn't know it existed. And I didn't know it existed because I've never let anybody take naked pictures of me, thank God. It's something not that I know about, exactly. And that's the scary part. I don't think they put it up on their website because they want people to go to the website and have it be an interesting experience, not a frightening one. But anyway, there's something out there that I didn't know about. It's called revenge porn, and it's always men. There may be a couple of women here and there, but it's mostly men, and they're having a great time with their girlfriend or their wife. Then things start to go bad, and they get angry, and what do? They post those naked pictures up on the internet to get back at them because they're mad. It's called revenge porn, and there was recently a case where a judge, ordered to pay a woman. The site was called You Got Posted, and they have to pay a woman $385,000 for posting sexually explicit images of her on their website. Now, as a lawyer, as someone who I'm sure is into free speech, what is your thoughts on this particular situation?
Well, I've done a little bit of research on it. The case that you're talking about, there's two sides to this. Well, there's actually three sides. There's a criminal element, which is if someone would violate a criminal statute. There's a civil element, which you are awarded with perhaps an injunction to where they can't do it anymore, and money damages. And then there's the third side of it, which is ethics and morals and just plain old good taste and being a good human being. They don't always mesh perfectly. The case that you are talking about, the problem with that case is not the outcome, it's how the outcome was arrived, which was it said it was a default judgment. So what happens in a default judgment really simply is if I file a lawsuit against you and you choose not to answer, I get a judgment from the court for whatever it is I asked for. So when you talk about a case like that having any true legal precedent, It does kind of, sort of, but not really, if you were to try to use that in a case. All that would really tell you is that, well, I'll tell you what it would tell me. It would tell me that the company that they sued just decided to go out of business.
Shut down, right.
And you get a $385,000 judgment against it. You can just paper the wall with it. So good luck. You could have a $385 million judgment. We don't care. We're out of business. From what I saw, and I didn't see the whole thing, if it would have been against an individual person, then they probably would have answered the lawsuit, and they probably would have, they would have fought it. I believe they would have ultimately lost with the big issue civil-wise is really an invasion of privacy, and you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and when these pictures are being taken, and if your boyfriend and girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever it is at the time, in the situation where the man is taking the picture of the woman, I think she has a reasonable expectation of privacy that those won't ever go out to, let's call it, the general public. But there's also other issues. There's a 2014 case in New York where they talk about, yes, you can have other civil remedies, but the person that they were trying to prosecute, the law, the statutes, and I'm talking about just New York, this, mm-hmm. they basically said, without saying it, that the statutes have not been updated. And so the posting these pictures on Twitter didn't amount to what they called a public dissemination of mm-hmm. the pictures. And so that can be argued one way or the other, but at least that's what one court in New York found. You know, and they mentioned, the court said, look, we think that this guy's actions are reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're bad, they're disgusting, but what they also said was, we are the judges, we are who follow the law. The prosecution must prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, as the Constitution says, and
right.
they didn't prove it. They proved some pretty ugly things, but they didn't prove it under the statute as written, and therefore mm-hmm. the motion to dismiss filed by the reprehensible defendant was granted, and there was no criminal action.
Oh, dear. We're talking to Drew Siegel. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to reintroduce
you. You want to or me?
No, you go. You just keep going. I want to hear you talk. It's more interesting when you talk than I talk. Go.
Well, I don't know about that. But what happens is the laws have to be updated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for example, and as I started to look into this, I tried to figure out who owns those pictures, okay?
That's what I was going to ask you. Mm-hmm.
Well, but the ownership of the picture, you can't cross who owns it and who's a despicable piece of shit human.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping that in mind, the Copyright Act talks about a work is, the title vests initially in the author of the work, okay? So now mm-hmm. we're talking about a picture. And now they're saying here, in a case, the person who creates the work is the author. And for photographs, the photographer is the creator of the work. And therefore, in this case, that image belongs to the man. But I'll tell you where they got that. They got that from... That's from a long time ago, when instead of photographs, it was drawings. So instead of a guy focusing and clicking, it was somebody who, let's say, spent 2 hours, 2 weeks, 2 months drawing a picture of a person,
mm-hmm.
and that picture belonged to them because they actually had to do something other than point and shoot. So some of that law probably does need to be updated. But
and that's funny.
Into,
I was going to say, well, you brought that up. That's go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to talk about, much of this I gleaned from this 2014 mm-hmm. New York case, where you talk about expectation of privacy. You can mm-hmm. argue, doesn't mean I believe it. You can argue that where these cases, from what I can gather, Trish, started was hidden cameras in dressing rooms.
Right.
Okay? You have a reasonable expectation when you're taking your clothes off in Target or whatever store, Macy's, that there's nobody watching you.
That's
and there's
right.
nobody filming you. Now, when someone takes, with boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it was, they take their clothes off and take the picture,
mm-hmm.
there's, when you are tweeting that out or on the internet to obviously try to damage that person who left you or broke you heart or whatever it is, there's really no legitimate purpose for that.
Right.
So, you know, it would be, I can't imagine where someone would consent to that. You can consent to taking a picture
mm-hmm.
and on your boyfriend's camera is not consent for him to try to embarrass you and ruin your life.
To use it later,
posting
right.
where everybody has. However, this New York court said,
mm-hmm.
in this particular case, he sent the naked pictures to the girl's sister. and a fellow employee, or no, I'm sorry, her employer, and he put it out on Twitter. Now, I happen to disagree with what the court said, but the court said sending it to two people is not a public dissemination, and Twitter, what your words did they use? They said it's a, it is subscriber-based, so it's not like putting the naked pictures on a billboard on a highway. They say they have to be subscribers to Twitter, which doesn't cost you anything, which anybody can be on Twitter. They say it's subscriber-based, and therefore we don't think that's a public dissemination. I think they reached the wrong conclusion there. I have no idea if they're going to appeal it to the New York Supreme Court, or perhaps to the United States Supreme Court, and I think that it's reasonable to think that that will be overturned.
It sounds like perhaps these judges aren't hip to what Twitter is, because a lot of people, you can go on Twitter and read. You don't have to join to read, I don't think. So I find that very very confusing, actually. We're talking with Texas Attorney Drew Siegel, and we're talking about revenge porn. There's been some movement in the laws in states. It's by state where these cases come about. And basically, you just can't take naked pictures of somebody and then when you get mad at them, post them on the Internet. That's kind of what this whole thing is about. And thank goodness it's being brought to light, because how many times have you heard of this happening, Drew? You know, somebody gets mad and boom, all of a sudden their naked pictures all over everybody's phone. You know, it happens with kids, unfortunately. And I'm glad to see this is being brought up and being stopped. But it's interesting because I was speaking to another person who is into law about this, and his big argument was, like you said, Drew, even though it's despicable, the guy owns the picture. He owns it, so he can do what he wants with it. I just don't see that. Just because he owns a picture doesn't mean he can destroy your life with it. That wasn't the intent.
I agree with that. Well, that's right. That's where the reasonable expectation of privacy, no legitimate purpose, and you're doing it just to hurt somebody. And you're not allowed to. That doesn't make it, unless a state passes a law that doing that is criminal, it's not criminal. It's disgusting, it's reprehensible, it's all those words, but it's not from a, illegal is wrongly, the word is used wrong. Illegal really means against a statute. If something is wrong or illegal in a civil case, there are statutes, but there's case law, and it has to do with damages, monetary damages. But to be truly illegal, it must be in violation of a criminal statute. And those criminal statutes are not always updated, and they must be what they call carefully construed and strictly construed.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right.
That's under the Constitution, the basic premise, innocent until proven guilty, and they must prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and you have to prove what the statute says. And if the statute is either poorly written or it is archaic in its writing, it is up to the legislature to change it.
Yes, absolutely.
The courts don't have the power to rewrite the law. The courts can only interpret it as it's written, and the legislature must change it.
And that's what we need to do, and we'll wait and see what happens here. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about this revenge porn. Drew, last time we had you on, you had some things kind of working up in the background. What's going on with your life? Anything you can talk about?
In the professional part, other than working hard every day, we're still working on a court show where I presumably will be the judge. Basically a court show which is in the likes of, say, Judge Judy, but hopefully with a little twist of what they tell me is my personality and language, we'll say. So
well, good.
hopefully just be a little twist. Other than that, I just get up every day and work very, very hard. And my kids are great, and I have a wonderful girlfriend, and she's terrific, and my dogs are good, and I got nothing to really complain about in the world.
Then, you know,
except,
what, my gosh.
Except revenge porn, but we'll come back to that.
We'll complain about that. Well, Drew, just remember the little people when you hit the big time, okay? Is that a deal?
I will. I still hope I hit the big time, and I will always remember.
There you go. Thank you, Drew. Thank you so much. We appreciate you coming on today. You take care now, all right?
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye-bye.
Drew Siegel, attorney at law. That sounds almost like a name of a superhero. He should wear a cape or something. Anyway, you can go to drewsiegellaw.com, and you can see his wonderful team of lawyers there if you're in Texas and you need a lawyer of some sort. I'm sure he can at least point you in the right direction if he can't actually practice that law. Okay, I want to talk about, real quickly, my iHeartRadio show, which is going to happen this upcoming Thursday, 8 o'clock Eastern, because it is what they call a trial show. It's not real easy to find, so you got to kind of watch where I post the links. It's in their Extreme Talk section, and it's the live section. If you go there Thursdays at 8 o'clock, you'll hear my show. You can also go to Wikipedia and look up Extreme Talk, and I think it's listed there as well. But this Thursday is going to be a very special show. It's a show that I've wanted to do for years, even before I started this show on Blog Talk. The Elizabeth Smart case. A lot of people think that case is closed, and it is, as far as Elizabeth's side of the story is. She was kidnapped. She was horribly abused. Her abusers are now behind bars for life. And she is doing very well. She's a lovely young lady. She's married, and everybody is happy for her. But there's a forgotten person in this scenario, and that is the handyman, Richard Reese. Actually, two forgotten people. Richard Reese, whom the police arrested and put him in prison. They violated his parole for drinking a beer, and they put him up at the Utah State Prison. They were so sure he kidnapped Elizabeth. They were absolutely positive that they questioned him and questioned him and questioned him until a vein in his head literally exploded and he died, leaving a widow, somebody that loved him. Granted, Richard was a criminal. I'm not going to paint him as some sort of angel. He wasn't. But he also was not the kidnapper of Elizabeth, and he was treated horribly. And there were lies told about him, and there were things said in the media that were not true. We're going to get the behind-the-scenes story, the true story of how that hysteria around the Elizabeth Smart case happened. And what was put out there was so wrong and so untruthful, but it made Richard Reese look guilty, and that's what they wanted. I don't know who did it. I don't know if it was the police, if it was the FBI, if it was the people that work the parole. I don't know. It was law enforcement. That's all I can say. We're going to have Richard's widow on, Angela Reese, and she is going to spill the beans. She's going to tell us everything she knows. Again, has nothing to do with Elizabeth Smart directly. We're not questioning that case at all. What it has to do with how Richard Reese was treated, how I feel, in my opinion, how they treated him led to his death, and there has been nothing done to change that perception that Richard Reese was this guilty, slimy person. That wasn't the case. So we're going to have Angela Reese on, and she will. It's going to be a very difficult and emotional show. But Angela has promised me she will tell us everything. I'm working with her as we speak to get the show ready so she knows exactly what she wants to say. I hope she has some evidence that she can share with us. That's what I'm hoping. But we will get the true story behind the case. Remember they had that very famous sketch artist, Jeannie Boylan, come in and do a sketch that the little girl, Elizabeth's little sister, saw. Why was that sketch never released? Why do you think? I don't know. I don't know. I would venture to guess because it didn't look like Richard Reese. That would be my guess. I don't know. Those are just some of the questions, but we do have answers, and we'll have that for you next Thursday on iHeartRadio.com in the Extreme Chat area. Extreme Talk area at 8 o'clock Eastern on Thursday. And be watching for the links. We'll just post them everywhere we possibly can. And we'll just go from there. So thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate the Blog Talk Show. It's fun. It is a nice change of pace from the iHeart, because the iHeart is very specific and you have to take commercial breaks and there are rules, and on this show I can do whatever the heck I want, and I love it. I love it. And don't forget, there are a few things that we do need to address here right at this very moment, and that is Trisha's True Crime Radio. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests, and Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. And it's also brought to you today by Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer a therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs. So they already have the disorder, and what helps them is they train these service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. It's all done by volunteers and donations. Go to www.pauseforpurpleheartsorg. Okay, everybody, we will see you again next week. Don't forget Thursday, iHeartRadio, Extreme Talk, 8 p.m. Eastern. We'll be there with the true story behind the other person accused of taking Elizabeth Smart, Richard Reese. And do remember this, Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we talk about current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.